don't think you should go on repeating yourself, you know. And I don't imagine that I'll be covering another Gulf War or another Afghan War. I think probably at my age it'd be rather silly to do that. I would rather do other things. I'd rather make good documentaries of a certain kind and write books or articles of a different kind, I think. But I felt it's good to get this one done, and it's the second half, after all. It sort of completes my memoirs, I suppose you could say. So I don't anticipate a third volume, really.
The question I'd have to ask you right away, of course, is what was by far the more satisfying? What most people would know you for, or this kind of escape from behind the desk and going off to do what a lot of people would say is the foreign correspondent's dream come true? Yep. Which was the more rewarding?
Oh, I think that, the foreign correspondent dream.
You said you think.
Oh, no, undoubtedly. That's just a sort of English, I think. Undoubtedly. Of course, I always was a foreign correspondent for Reuters for 10 years and then for ITN for 5 years. So taking all that together, that was 15 years from the age of about 28 or something, in which I did virtually nothing else except to be a foreign correspondent. And then I got a good deal when I started newscasting. I think possibly I wanted to do that because I was asked, actually, by the then editor. He said, I want you to newscast after the Vietnam War. After the Tet Offensive during the Vietnam War, 68. I came back. I was up to here, I think, with wars anyway. And he said, look, I want you to newscast. I want to strengthen the team. I want your authority. He was kind
gravitas
enough.
Gravitas or whatever word was used.
Yes, exactly. So I said yes. And on the basis, though, that I was still allowed to report, I let off the leash now and again. And of course, when the Afghan thing sort of came up, I thought, well, here's Vietnam in reverse, as you might say. This is the Russian Vietnam. We ought to report it. It wasn't really being reported. And maybe I was a bit bored sitting behind the desk, too. But I think the other reason was more important. And I said, can we go and report it? I asked ITN, and I got Central to agree.
So we're interrupting you, but all through the book, this comes across that you had to get off your seat and go and say, hey, look, I think we should be doing something about this.
Yes.
And you make reference to the fact, you mentioned the chap by name, John Mahoney,
if that's the
name.
Yeah.
The best foreign editor that ITN ever had.
Yes.
But at other parts of the book, you're kind of putting the elbow in and saying, these desk-bound wallahs. And you don't always put it as politely as that. But you had to go and say, hey, I want to go and do this, and this is what the viewers will want to actually see on the box. Was it like that? Did you have to get up and say, hang on, I'm a bit fed up reading the news tonight. Let's go and see this.
Well, I think only occasionally. Afghanistan, certainly, that's true. You're absolutely right. I don't know why, really, because ITN had covered Afghanistan in the early days of the war, and then there was, up until about, I would say, mid or end of 1980, they were covered it. That's to say, for the first year of the Afghan War. And then somehow nobody was covering it. It was sort of so remote, so difficult to get in and out.
It's a bit like it is today, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But now there's no interest. There was great interest. Well, there should have been. After all, here were the Russians, 80,000 or whatever, Russian troops occupying this backward, perhaps not in itself terribly important country, but strategically important because, as it was pointed out, when the Russians had their jets in Afghanistan, they were only 5 minutes flying time from the Gulf and the oil. And also, next door, of course, was Pakistan, which was an ally.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. So there was surely, there should have been a great interest. But I don't know, for some reason, neither ITV or the BBC seemed to be terribly interested. I immediately got a very good response there when I went to David Nicholas, the editor of ITN, and said, look, shouldn't we be covering this? I want to go. He said, yes, okay.
Would that happen today, do you think, Sandy? Because the purse string boys they're all through.
Yes, they're all
newspapers,
through.
Television, radio. It's almost as if the world is ruled by accountants as opposed to Philadelphia lawyers kind of thing.
Yes.
Would it be the same? Because I think a lot of people would see you as part of a time in television when the standard of reporting and the characters doing it, and this is not meant to be criticism of today's presenters or reporters, they were different. It has changed, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know that it's very difficult for me to say. But I would have thought that people like Martin Bell for the BBC and...
But he's been around a long time.
He has, that's true. The New Wave, well, Paul Davies, I suppose, has also been around for ITN for quite a few years now. He's a very good reporter. He goes to all these hotspots. I think the breed of journalist is still there. They have to work perhaps slightly under different constraints. I think you're right.
Hang on a sec, Sandy, hang on. In you come. Sorry we kept you waiting. Come and join us in the studio. We're, of course, in the author's studio tonight, and if you don't recognise the voice of your guest this evening, I will be amazed. However, just in case you've just come down from the moon, in the studio with us tonight is Sandy Gall, of course, News at 10, and we are talking about his book, News from the Front, which he subtitles The Life of a Television Reporter. It's published by Heinemann, and this is not a television reporter padding around the Old Bailey, trotting along to Westminster. This is not knocking on government ministers' doors. This is the television reporter going abroad into the hot spots, the sticky spots. We're with Sandy in Vietnam, we're with him in the Gulf War, we're with him several times in Afghanistan, we're with him in Pakistan, we're with him abroad, being the foreign correspondent. And I was saying, just before you joined us, which was the better way of life? Sitting at the desk, reading the news, looking as if autocue wasn't in front of him, or getting abroad? And, well, just you guess what his answer was. Sandy, thanks for coming in and talking to us about News from the Front.
Pleasure, Alex.
We were saying just now that the industry has changed, that there's a far greater inclination to check the sheets, the balance sheets, almost the petty cash box before people go. Let me ask you, does that, do you believe, alter television coverage, news coverage, today compared to a few years ago?
I think it must restrict it. I think that the big stories are still covered equally at length and, you know, professionally by ITN and BBC, so that Bosnia, for example, is done, I think, in exactly the way we would have done it.
Or is that Sarajevo you're talking about?
Well, maybe Sarajevo, yeah.
It's like all the cameras are up in Aberdeen, but what's going on in Edinburgh and Glasgow, we're not seeing.
Well, you might have a point there. I mean, saturation coverage, yes. I'm slightly out of touch, so I don't really know if, for example, there's an argument for having cameras up at Mostar or whatever, all these places that General Sir Michael Rose, who I admire, incidentally, is now talking about. These will be the next places to look at, you know, to do a Sarajevo. Yeah. Maybe you're right. I think that certainly there are much greater financial restrictions today. The budget is much more important, and I think that perhaps if I was to go today as I did 10 years ago, 11 years ago, whatever it was, and say, look, I want to go to Afghanistan, this is an important war, they might well say, well, we can't afford it. And if somebody says we can't afford it, then that's the end of the argument, really, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you can't... so I think we are living in... Certainly the last two or three years have been more difficult because revenue's been down and budgetary considerations have been enormous. I suppose, looking back, it was a golden age. I mean, yes. One was awfully lucky to...
To have been in there, been
to
be
a foreign correspondent when, as you might say, almost the heyday.
I was intrigued very early on in News from the Front when you talked about writing up your diary. Have you always kept a diary? I mean, in other words, is this the kind of book that 10, 15 years ago you thought, yes, Gall, when I'm no longer charging around the world, I will write myself this book?
Well, I wasn't quite as sort of, I'm too disorganized to think, plan ahead so carefully. Maybe subconsciously. My father used to say to me, you ought to keep a diary because, as they say, when you're in your old age, it'll keep you. Now, I never did, actually. That was excellent advice. I didn't take it. I only started keeping, although perhaps it, you know, it did have an impact, an effect on me. I started keeping it only, I think, a diary properly when I started going to places like Vietnam and so on. And I only kept it when
during
I was abroad.
The war.
During the war,
yes.
Yes, when I covered the Vietnam War, so, which started in 65 and finished in 75.
There's a lovely chapter, and forgive me interrupting you, Sandy, a lovely section of the book where you go back to sea again. And it's very much, I'll give this as a first example, but it wasn't necessarily yours. All the girly bars are closed down.
Yes.
They aren't as they were. They are trying very hard to get up onto their legs again, and there's a kind of a minder who reminded me, the way you described him, was a sort of Peter Lorre figure.
Yes.
Who figures very largely in that section because he was the archetypical capitalist in the midst of communism, on the make all the time.
Exactly.
I mean, he's a great character to look back on, isn't he?
Absolutely true. Yes, you know, quite amazing. They, as you say, one expected a communist sort of straight up and down official apparatchik who would say niet or no, you know, because they were very close to the Russians, the Vietnamese communists. But to my surprise, and it didn't take long. I mean, the first intimation was when I said, "Now we need to go to the bank tomorrow." Shortly after arriving in Hanoi, he said, "There's no need to go to the bank. I will do it for you." Yeah. Oh, really, Mr. Kang? Mm-hmm. Now, what's the official rate? I think the official rate was 1.1 dong, which is a pretty worthless currency, really, to the dollar, which was real high daylight robbery. But he said, "Oh, no, I can get you much better than that, 1.5. Well, the real black market rate was about 10.
As you found out.
As we found out.
When you went to this beautiful little eatery.
Yes.
Yes.
So he conned us, of course, like nobody's business. The quid pro quo was, of course, that we got the shots of the tricky ones that they might have said no to. And you know, when you're in their hands, because when you're desperately trying to make some films against the odds, perhaps occasionally.
You don't want to see kindergartens with little flags all the time.
Exactly, yes. Which they offer you.
Singing party songs.
So he really had us over a barrel, and boy, did he exploit it. I mean, he ended up several hundred dollars richer, which would be like sort of 2 years' wages or something.
Yes.
So he was, but he was remarkable. But he did, of course, you know, he was so astute and shrewd and grasping that, in fact, he was very useful to us.
Mm-hmm. I loved the way when you were leaving him or flying off, he had the good idea he was going to get a present. And when you went into the store, there was only one thing he wanted. "I'm not going to tell, and neither should you. Make people enjoy that for themselves." But then he was pointing,
quite surprising,
like a schoolboy in a big toy store, looking up at one thing, and then you got it for him.
Yes.
Clearly, because the book begins and ends with Afghanistan and the problems of Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan. That has burned a real hole in you, Sandy, hasn't it? In the sense that it's not like, for example, that you were in the Gulf War, you reported that, the freedom of Kuwait, the war, Schwarzkopf, and so on. But you don't give nearly as much space to that, nor, if I dare say this, as much feeling to that as you do to Afghanistan.
Well, I'm sure your perception is probably pretty accurate, but because you're one of the few reviewers I know who always reads the book and knows it better than perhaps the author almost by the end of it. But in Vietnam, I mean, I covered Vietnam for 10 years, but and the Afghans, curiously, the span of the Afghan war was almost exactly the same, in my coverage anyway. But you see, there were so many people covering Vietnam. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of foreign journalists, British, mostly American, but lots of British, lots of French. Everybody under the sun covered Vietnam. And it's true, I didn't get quite so deeply involved, although, I mean, I did cover it pretty intensively to begin with. And then I started newscasting, so I was kind of distanced from it. But my point I would like to say that the point I'd like to make is that in the Afghan war, very few people were covering it. Therefore, when I first went in 82, it was really a voyage of discovery. We didn't know really what we were going to find. The Russians, of course, were there. And the question was, could this small backward nation of 15 million people, could they withstand this tremendous onslaught by the superpower, by a superpower, the Russian sort of juggernaut, you know? They'd seen off the British, in a way, once spectacularly, you know, in three Anglo-Afghan wars in the previous century. But one, the last war actually was in the 1920. But would they do the same with the Russians? It was a fascinating proposition, which I tried to answer in 82, 84, 86. I made three long journeys. But there was nobody else, it seemed to me, or very few other people in the picture. So in a way, I became absorbed in the answer, who will win? Will the Russians, as a lot of experts here thought, must win, you know, simply because of their overall superiority in might and jets and tanks and what have you. And perhaps so I did get professionally very involved. I was also asked to start a charity, which may or may not have been the right thing for journalists to do, which I did do to sort of help disabled Afghans. And that was when I published my first book on Afghanistan in 83. And so that has kept alive my interest, but it's basically a journalistic interest. And I would like, really, I'm still involved and still interested because I would like to see them reach, you know, have some sort of happy ending. I'd like a happy ending. I'd like
to
see.
There isn't one, no.
There isn't one. It's disaster right now. They're killing one another in even a more savage way, I think, than is happening in Bosnia. There have been, since the 1st of January, when there was an attempted coup in Kabul, something like, I read the other day, a Red Cross figure, 800 killed and thousands wounded and thousands more refugees from their own capital city. The city looks like Beirut looked at the height of that war. Yeah. So it's a desperate business. Nobody's paying much attention, any attention to it, really.
I'm going to interrupt you again because there's a reference in the book to having your correspondence suits made for you. And I was looking at the picture on the back, and it's the baggy trousers and the... How would you describe a foreign correspondence suit?
Well, it varies, you see. I mean, I think I was talking about the days in Vietnam when there was a very good tailor right in the middle of in Saigon who used to make a very sharp safari suit, you know. And he would made to measure and so on. And it was very hot and humid in Saigon, so these were very lightweight. But in Afghanistan, the safari suit is the sort of baggy trousers, shirt and trousers, you're quite right, which is worn by the locals, and which they liked you to wear to sort of draw less attention to yourself. And I'd say, I don't want to wear, politely, I'd say, why do we have to wear this? Can I not wear my trousers? Because those things, you know, are difficult to wear. They don't have any fly buttons to be to be direct about it. You have to take them down if you want to go to the bathroom. Yeah. And they've got no pockets either, unless you have them specially made. So they're kind of inconvenient. But they would always used to say, no, no, because there are spies. We'd rather you wore, you know, then nobody can see that you're obviously a Westerner. So, but that's a very different kind of unsmart foreign correspondence suit.
You're a great chap, Sandy Wonder, for always, I was going to say, dressing for the part, but in an essential sense. I mean, there you were with the Mujahideen, is that the pronunciation?
Yeah.
Looking like one of them and travelling through the country on horseback, weeks of over the rocks, over the mountains, down through the gullies. In for example, in the Middle East during the Gulf War, you were constantly getting into trouble because you insisted on looking the part to get through checkpoints and so on. On with the tin helmets, chaps. We've got the noddy suits on top. We look as if we're military. They won't ask us any questions.
Yeah.
That's almost, in the nicest possible way, a kind of boy's own approach to it, isn't it? Nothing will get in the way of getting the story. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, all right, you can ridicule it, but...
I wasn't ridiculing it. I was quoting from the book.
I see. Yes, I know. But, well, I think you had to do that in the Gulf. I mean, I hope I don't do it for show, although I must confess that when I was in the Gulf and we were having those Scud attacks on Riyadh right at the beginning of the air war... I had to stand up on the roof of the hotel and give sort of live interviews to both ITN and other people. And I used to, because it was cold up on the roof early in the morning there, I used to wear this uniform, you know, the NBC, yes, nuclear biological chemical warfare suit, protective suit.
And you always had trouble with the boots, didn't you?
The boots, you're quite right. They're awful pain to put on. And I got a message one day from London saying the editor doesn't want you to wear that suit anymore. And I was furious because I thought, well, it's all very well for him, but supposing there is a Scud attack, you know.
And it does contain some nasties.
It does contain some nasties in it. Anyway, I didn't wear it for a couple of days, and then I did put it on, and we had a truce after that. But when we came to the ground war, because as you know, the air war lasts a long time, you couldn't really get to grips with it, I mean, in journalistic terms. But we all knew that Saddam would not withdraw. We all guessed he wouldn't withdraw. We knew the ground war would therefore take place when the ultimatum ran out. So we all have made our preparations to cover the ground war in our different ways. And, you know, it was, I think, one's responsibility to try to get the news. So we knew, my little lot, my team, we knew that the only way we'd get through the Red Box was by dressing up in the approved manner. So really, it was part of the job. And it wasn't for effect, that's what I'm trying to say, not for effect, really to do the job. And it worked. And we, you know, I mean, we did put on the NBC suits. We did put on the steel helmets. We painted up our vehicle to look like a coalition. All the coalition vehicles engaged in Desert Storm. had these inverted V's.
Why did you use the American definition as opposed to Operation Granby?
Oh, sorry,
the Brits always call it.
We always, yes. I'd forgotten about Operation Granby. I mean, that was a ridiculous, I think, British name.
I interrupted you. They all had painted.
They all had inverted V's. You had to have five on each vehicle to not draw friendly fire, because otherwise you could be thought to be the enemy. And you also had to have an orange cloth on the roof. And if you didn't have that, you were liable to be shot up. So we did most of it. We did the inverted V's using black camera tape. But we forgot. We were told, actually, by, I hate to say it, by a colleague, that we didn't need the orange cloth on the roof.
You protest about that. I was assured we didn't need that. Yeah.
That's right, yes. Absolutely. And then it got us blown away. Mm. Because when we got through the roadblocks thanks to a combination of uniforms, NBC suits. It's a charcoal line suit, by the way, so it makes you very dirty, but it keeps you very warm. They're warm. And tin hats and so on. And the cameraman who drove, and he pretended to be an American. Every time we got the roadblock, he used to say, "Hi, guys," and put his foot on the accelerator.
Steve.
Steve. Yes, he was brilliant. So we got to the border, knowing that the ground offensive was going to start next day. At 8 o'clock local time, that was when the ultimatum expired. And there we were, sitting on the border, when, you know, then somebody whizzed up in a Jeep, in a Toyota Land Cruiser, and we followed them, thinking Steve was convinced that they were journalists, and they knew exactly what they were doing, and we followed them right up to the border and then into the desert, and then found ourselves in the middle of the Saudi build up. And out stepped not, we thought, journalists, as Steve confidently predicted, but four officers who I thought were going to arrest us, Saudi officers, who, when they said, "Who are you?" I said, "We're British." "British what?" "British television, actually." "Oh, British television? What are you doing here? You shouldn't be here." And then they started muttering, and I thought, we better get out. We got out very rapidly. Luckily, they were so busy doing their own thing that they went away.
You didn't have to go very far, though, just out of sight, didn't
you? Just out of sight. We just turned round. We went turned round there and got out of the got out of the picture very quickly. And there was a dip, luckily, so we were able to hide in there. And 10 minutes later, the build-up was now reaching really impressive proportions. Tanks, armoured personnel carriers, truckloads of troops. And when we went back up over the ridge, they'd gone. Mm. So it was quite obvious the advance was
going to start. The game was on.
The game was on. Mm. And 10 minutes later, we were over the border.
Sandy, what comes through very clearly in News on the Front, in, let's just say, situation after situation, is the importance of getting on very well with people. I was going to say contacts, but that's fairly obvious.
Yes.
From the ruler of Pakistan.
Yes, General Zia. Yes.
Giving you a call and saying, "Hey, I think you should have a look at this kind of idea."
Yes.
Through to 2 hours in Schwarzkopf's company during the Gulf. Across to the Mujahideen, where you got on very well with the, in theory, the man who was going to lead the country out of its trouble, who was in his 20s, Mossad. Is that something that you believe is what you brought to it, or something that is part and parcel of the job? What I'm really trying to say is, does Sandy Gall always fall over backwards to be a nice chap, because he is a nice chap, or in that situation, those situations down through the years, have you got to cultivate a persona of, well, no matter how much he rubs my nose in it, I'm going to get this story?
I think if they rubbed your nose in it too much, you would say to hell with to hell with you. But I think that you are trying to get something achieved, so you probably are. You're minding your P's and Q's. I think that's perfectly true.
It's like MI6, ain't you? Look, let's pop around. Let's have a chat. And what did you learn when you were out there, Sandy? You know?
Well, not quite. Yes, not quite like that. Mm. I mean, I wouldn't want to give the wrong impression about my contacts with MI6, but why I was interested in their assessment, I think they're very good at their job, incidentally, and which is gathering information, and I wanted to know what was happening across the border in Afghanistan, because I thought, if we're going to go in, I don't want to be ambushed by the Russians, because, you know, the KGB, in those days, they were making very threatening noises about journalists who came in, and one or two did get picked up and were sentenced to 20 years in jail. They got them out. There were two French, there was a French doctor and a French journalist, television journalist, who both had that experience. They got them out, but, you know, 6 months in an Afghan jail, not very pleasant. Yeah. So I wanted to know what was waiting for us on the other side. But I think what I would say in answer to your question is, I think you've got to be straight with people. And I always felt that you have to go back. Therefore, if you drop somebody in the proverbial, they don't want to see you when you come back the next time, and very often you will have to go back. And if you have sort of queered your pitch, you know, that's not very clever. So, because you just don't go the one time if you're a foreign correspondent, you probably go back and back and back. Therefore, you have to build up the contacts, as you say then. And I think you have to establish trust so that they say, yes, we'll talk to you. This time we want it to be off the record. But this is what's happening. Next time we can give you an interview or whatever, you know. And I think you've got to operate on a basis that you...
But I can imagine you still, for example, sending off a... Christmas card is not applicable in this context, but sending out the odd note now and again to Prince Turkey out in,
in
Saudi Arabia.
That's absolutely true. I haven't actually... been in contact with them recently, but I always get a Christmas. I know my daughters would say this was name dropping, but I always get a Christmas card from King Hussein and send him one, and from his brother, Crown Prince Hassan. Anyway, that's
Sandy Heinemann. Clearly, I've got a very good read from Sandy Gall News from the front. I've got one question I've really got to ask you. Although the going was very tough, very strenuous in many of these situations you described, as the life of a television reporter, a foreign correspondent television reporter. What I've got to ask you is this. What was really boring? What really got you down? Not about abroad, but just say in the entire context of people or television programs, what really wore you down?
Oh, probably.
Perhaps I'm saying who.
Well, I think bureaucrats wear you down.